skiddle-doo, I said bebop. Skiddle-doo, I said beb. Skiddle-doo, I said skid-a-bop. Skiddle-doo, I said bebop-boom.
This is the Freshman 15.
My name's Jeremy Bear, and shit's about to get real. What do you say, boys? You ready to save the world? Classified, huh? Well, classified this. Baby, you just fucked with the wrong hombre. Two hits. Me hitting you, and you, whatever, you get the point. I wanted to have a bunch of options. They're all good. We could use any of them.
My name's Daniel Long, and sometimes people call me Mike Lowry. Sometimes people call me Mike Lowry. Mike Lowry.
All right, Daniel. Well, do we have any listener feedback this month?
You know what? I don't think we do.
No?
I don't. I mean, there hasn't been a lot.
You know, where are the Nate Dunleavys and the people that would write us these beautiful notes that we could share? And
I mean, I could call them.
You call who?
I could call Nate.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think he's in Indiana, but... Sure, give him a call.
Okay, I'll just get him on the phone.
Okay.
Hey, Nate. So, yeah, we're recording tonight, and, you know, we really appreciate your feedback, and we'd love to... Okay, cool. I guess I'll see you later.
Was that really him?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Hey guys, what's up?
Nate.
In the flesh, boys. How you doing?
Doing great, Nate. So thanks for answering the call.
No, so I had a couple of thoughts about the Spike Lee episode, which unfortunately I tried to listen to with my family, but the discussion of polyamorous women in the 1980s did not go over all that great with my 9 and 11-year-old.
Yeah.
That aside, I really resonated with a lot of things you guys were saying about just being able to emotionally connect to the work of Spike Lee. That impacted me, but mm-hmm. You know, I've never really felt, you know, emotionally tied to his work, and in large part because I think he's telling stories for his particular point of view, and he doesn't really care whether I like him or not. He's just trying to help me understand the world, and I think I'm a better person for that. So I don't know why I didn't have a lot of emotional, you know, resonance with She's Gotta Have It. I still feel like his work is valuable in the world, and I really appreciated your guys' thoughts and opinions on it. So, you know, I'll take my comments off the air. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks, Nate.
From Indiana.
And it looks like he's getting in an Uber, and there he goes. That was really sweet of you to stop by. And as always, some terrific insight from Nate Dunleavy.
Yeah.
Really interesting points. And first of all, I want to say thank you for validating our discussion and our feelings on it. You know, the truth of the matter is I don't like, and this probably is part of just enjoying the privilege of being a white male in the United States. I chafe a little at this idea that there's things that are being made out in the world that aren't for me. It just feels wrong.
What I think one of my favorite comments from the last episode that you said, Jeremy, was that Spike Lee is my type of filmmaker until I watch his films. And I've thought about that, and I think that is such a helpful way of thinking about it, because you do have like two things constantly going on, right? You have like the conversation around films that are going on, and then you actually have the being able to immerse yourself into the art of what's happening. It's good that we have Spike Lee to do maybe the former, and maybe he doesn't have to do the latter for everybody.
Yeah, and you know, and Nate also brings up another interesting point, which is something that I've only recently begun to realize, is that some of our listenership are young people.
Right.
And I've heard about this here and there through the grapevine.
When you say young, clarify.
Well, I mean, I know that I've heard about this from a few different people, that they have kids that listen to our podcast. And by kids, I mean, you know, these are sometimes 12, 13, 14-year-old kids, which is sobering. And I'm trying not to let it influence me too much. But on the other hand, there is a part of me that's like, how cool that there are kids at that age level that want to interact with film in the way and at the depth that we're trying to here on the podcast. I actually take a lot of inspiration from that.
I for sure do. And I would love to hear like what it is they have to say,
yeah,
right, about the conversation. Even maybe they haven't seen the films, maybe they it's not appropriate for them to watch the films, or at least all the films that we're talking about. But I remember being that age, right, and being engaged in watching movies. I wish I had a few more tools or a few some more language with which to watch these movies. It's so touching to me to think different ages are kind of entering into our conversation. I mean, I feel so...
And maybe even hopefully continuing this conversation.
Right, and I feel really humbled by that and really grateful.
I do too. So if it's not already obvious, we're very grateful for all our listeners. In particular, tonight, good old Nate Dunleavy, but all of our listeners, thanks so much for joining us in the conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So what do you say, brother?
Let's do it.
All right.
You guys are cops! I can't believe this! I should turn you into hard copy! Put your ass on a TV set!
Yo, what are you doing, man?
I got this! Jojo? I got 15 bullets in this gun.
Mike!
And I swear, if you don't start talking to him, I'm gonna fill your lying ass full of some hot shit. Now, what's up?
Mike! He's a former ganja-smoking motherfucker. He ain't worth it. Do you want something? I'll bust your ass, too. So sad. You on your own, JoJo.
So, Daniel, true story.
Mm-hmm.
Months ago, when we were talking to the fellas over at the Hold Up about switching podcasts with them and all that, which turned out to be a fun little experiment. If you haven't heard it yet, go back in time, listen to the Freshman 15 episode on the freshman film of Rob Zombie or Robert Cummings, which is House of a Thousand Corpses. House of a Thousand Corpses. Put on by John and John, which was a great episode. And
what
we swapped.
Pick. I constantly think about that pick, and it just couldn't be more perfect.
It was super fun. And of course, we returned the favor by reviewing Crocodile Dundee over on their podcast. But we gave them the requisite.
Mm-hmm.
Just make it a director that we would never do.
Right.
So John Nelson said, okay, we've got two candidates of directors we're pretty sure you're never going to do. They're Rob Zombie. And the other director that we know would never, ever end up on the Freshman 15 is Michael Bay.
Michael Bay.
And in communication with the Hold Up guys, I had to say, you know what? I really hate to tell you this, but summer's coming and Daniel and I have a Michael Bay episode planned.
So we're doing Michael Bay.
We're doing Michael Bay.
That's tonight.
Hashtag Bay him.
Bay him.
And I know we teased last time. Yep. We got a little something coming for the summer months. Mm-hmm. So Daniel, why don't you tell our listeners what it is that we have up our sleeves?
So here's what we're doing. So for the next three episodes for the summer, we're going to focus on directors whose freshman films were blockbusters.
And specifically, directors who are known primarily, if not exclusively,
for the blockbuster.
For blockbusters. And who is more explosive a blockbuster director than Michael Bay? And that was true all the way back to his freshman film, Bad Boys.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I heard a quote from Michael Bay.
Yeah.
And he said, I want to make summer movies for people to enjoy.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, this was like a quote that I heard in an interview that I think took place probably 7 years ago. But
So this wasn't like about, it wasn't back in the Bad Boys days that he was saying
this. Not back in the Bad Boys days, but I think he knew then the kind of movies he wanted to make.
You know what's really interesting about Michael Bay? Because he's another one of these directors that people seem to know who he is and the kinds of things he does. It's always funny, I feel like, when we talk about some of these directors that, I mean, for the most part, I think we've talked pretty exclusively about bigger name directors, but he gets into the mainstream sort of consciousness. And when people hear Michael Bay, even non-film people are just like, oh, well, we're going to see stuff blowing up.
Oh, yeah, they know.
And we're going to see one-liners, and we're going to see, you know, we're going to see big things crashing into other big things and all that. And it's just, and it's become like a joke. Like, you'll see memes on the internet of, you'll see a big tanker truck that says flammable on the back, and see like another bus coming from another direction. It'll be like, directed by Michael Bay or something. It's just everyone knows the Michael Bay formula, it feels like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've seen different parodies, right? Like, what if Michael Bay directed a chess game? Like, that's an actual video on YouTube. So people know his style. I do feel like people make fun of it. He's an easy one to target.
Because Michael Bay is associated, of course, with, you know, much like James Cameron, enormous budgets. But unlike James Cameron, he didn't really start from humble beginnings feature film-wise. It just felt like right off the bat, with Bad Boys. He was into this sweeping smash right through the back of your skull imagery, not just expensive, but Jerry Bruckheimer expensive.
Oh, right.
He was that guy. His first time out, he had, I mean, he didn't have the budget that he has now, but he was doing the big summer spectacle movies right off the bat with Bad Boys.
Yeah, so I think Bad Boys was, I think it cost around $15 million to make. And it, to
oh,
me,
wow. See, I didn't realize that. I would have thought more.
I was about to say, it feels like a movie that's bigger, right? Yeah. Bigger budgeted. Michael Bay, if you look at IMDb, I mean, his directing credits go on and on. But he has very few. There isn't too many feature films.
Bad Boys is what we're here to talk about. Right. Martin Lawrence and Will Smith. Daniel, do that thing that I know you do so well. Bad Boys.
You want me to premise this?
For those who haven't seen it or don't know.
Premise this bitch. I feel like that's what Will Smith would say. Or
probably.
Okay. So yeah, so Bad Boys is about two Miami cops. And really the film starts off with this heist, right? Where all this heroin is stolen and these two cops you know, played by Martin Lawrence and Will Smith. The whole plot is them trying to recover this heroin.
Yeah, heroin that was stolen from police
from the precinct,
inventory.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Will Smith's character kind of solicits the help of, is she a prostitute, I'm assuming? She gets involved. She ends up getting killed by the people who stole this heroin. Taya Leone's character was a friend. She's on the run. They take her into protective custody. There's a mix-up between who is who, right? It is Martin Lawrence's character is mixed up with Will Smith's character, and so for the most, a lot of the film, they're playing one another.
Right.
Shit blows up.
A lot of shit blows up.
Things get crazy. Mm. Bad boys, what you gonna do?
What you gonna do?
Yeah.
And it occurs to me halfway through your premise / summary, who really cares
exactly
what it's about? You know?
That's the thing.
It doesn't really matter.
No.
If you don't get it, you're gonna enjoy it about as much as if you do get it. That's all right. That's the Michael Bay formula. Plot holes and contrivances. If you're going to get hung up on stuff like plot holes, you're probably not going to bother anyway.
That's one of my questions, right? I mean, what matters? It seems like the things about the plot are little pieces to make these other things the things to look at.
I'm curious, Daniel, when did you first see Bad Boys? When you saw it, be honest, what did you think?
I saw it in 1995 when it came out.
Is that true?
It's true. I was 13 years old. Mm. So this movie was incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, like when I saw it, I remember thinking, this is awesome.
13, sure.
Yeah. So seeing it in the theater, that's a type of movie you want to see in the theater.
Yeah.
Will Smith. I knew Will Smith, you know, already Fresh Prince. I thought it was a funny show. It was something I watched.
I'm trying to remember in 1995... did Will Smith even have a film career? Is this one of his first forays into feature films?
I think this is a film that made him an action star.
Okay.
I don't know how many. I think he did have some film credit.
He was still early.
Yeah.
But he was still the Fresh Prince.
Still the Fresh Prince. And I don't think people knew Will Smith to be the guy who's running in slow motion with the shirt open.
Yeah.
Right? Until this movie.
Yeah. And banging broads.
That's who he is after this movie. I remember enjoying it.
Yeah.
This was great. This was cool. So for you.
So I did not catch Bad Boys at the time. I'd be lying if I said that there was ever a period in my life where I was a big time actiony movie going guy. There are some that I think are great and I like and I even return to. It didn't really seem to be the kind of thing I was going to pursue in 1995. I didn't really see Bad Boys at all. I want to say this was probably 5 or 6 years ago. And I've mentioned this in the past that when I work, whether it's on an illustration or something like that, I like to have movies playing. And you'll go through different phases. I've found that my personal rhythm that I work best in is to have a movie playing that's more of like an intellectual or acting type film. Definitely not like a spectacle film or something like that. It's a lot of times with the director's commentary going. And so, you know, to have this playing on a screen over here while over here I'm drawing or painting or, you know, storyboarding or something. So I went through a phase where I was trying to see if it would help my process if I would have these sort of bombastic movies. And so I went through a period, I think, of like a couple of months where I was trying it. And again, I could tell while it was going that it was not, it was more distracting.
It wasn't working.
Yeah, it didn't really help my process. And so that was a helpful lesson for me in terms of creatively. But one of the movies that I tried out, during that was Bad Boys.
That was your first time?
It was the first time I'd ever seen it. And I put "seen" in quotes because I was kind of only half paying attention to it. I sort of was semi-aware of drugs and explosions and hookers and that kind of stuff. But I wasn't really paying close attention. I just kind of got the general gist. So in all honesty, I didn't have a focused viewing of it until, well, quite frankly, in the last few weeks when I was prepping for this. And I was like, okay, no, I really want to take this thing in. And it's probably a little past its due date for me personally.
Yeah, nobody's ever said what you just said. That the first time that you saw Bad Boys
was while I was trying to create art. So yeah, you know, I pulled it up on the old tablet and I watched it on an airplane, which is...
Wait, so real quick, I just want to highlight the fact that we couldn't have watched it in a more different way.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So a 13-year-old in the theater... 40-year-old on the smallest screen possible.
On an airplane tray table.
Yeah, right. That's so great. I love that.
It was definitely, I mean, it's far from the first Michael Bay movie I had seen, but it was intriguing. And we say this all the time on this show, how much the later works of that director are already reflected in the early works. I mean, just, you know, Michael Bay in 1995 was already Michael Bay.
Have we talked about a director where it just seems like his style was fully realized by the first film?
Yeah.
It feels as if has not changed
right
one bit since.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the amount of money, but otherwise, no, he's the guy that he was. So I want to talk about this a little bit. People hear Michael Bay, they think of explosions and they think of summer popcorn movies and all that. But I feel like there's a lot more that makes a Michael Bay movie than just explosions and big budgets.
Right.
And I was hoping to get into a few more of those things.
Let's do it.
One thing, a really, really specific type of humor is in every Michael Bay movie. And it's such a hard thing that I was trying to define it for myself in my mind. What is Michael Bay funny? Because you know it when you see it.
Yeah.
He has the same types of jokes in every movie. It's partly in the editing. It's partly in the performances. It's not a mature humor. Mm-hmm. It's a very obvious humor. It's just this kind of punch you in the face. I'm trying real hard to be funny. And yeah. I'm going to punctuate all my jokes with something that's kind of visceral. But I don't know. What is that?
I don't know what that is. I mean, I can think of it. So thinking of Bad Boys, there's that moment, right? It's toward the end of the film. The bad guys come after Mike and Marcus, mm-hmm. shoot up the hotel lobby, and then they're running. There's this moment when Will Smith kind of goes, he's chasing a character that goes through like a salon. Mm-hmm. He goes through the salon, right? They shoot him up. He's diving. All these old ladies are getting perms.
Yes.
Right? You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. This is a perfect example of Michael Bay funny.
Right before Will Smith is about to get up to run outside, mm-hmm. he looks at the women and he says, "You all look great, by the way."
"It's okay. It's okay. I'm with the police. It's cool. You look great."
That is a moment that's just saying, I want you to laugh here.
Yeah.
This would never happen, but it does in my films.
Right. The joke that they're not saying is, isn't it funny that someone as cool and attractive as Will Smith is in the midst of these ugly women, but he's acting like they're not ugly. Mm-hmm. Isn't that funny? And there's a side of it where you're just like, ugh.
Yeah.
Michael Bay jokes to me, that's always my reaction. Ugh.
Ugh. I had this moment when I was watching the film. I thought of your face. And I thought of you just saying like, Like, I honestly thought of that noise. Like, and kind of like the tilt of the head, right? And like the closing of the eyes, like, eh. Like, and I thought, this is what Jeremy's feeling right now. So, yeah. I think it's so good.
You know me.
I do.
But you know what? It leads into another thing that I think is in basically every Michael Bay film, that a couple of different observations specifically about how women are treated and portrayed in Michael Bay films. First of all, women 100%, and I think this is true in every single Michael Bay film, women are props every time. There's no such thing as a woman with an actual human motivation, with any sort of depth, with any sort of intricacy of character. Mm-hmm. They're props. And there's only two kinds of women in Michael Bay films. They're either porny or they're ugly, skaggy women to laugh at.
Interesting. So I see.
I don't think that there, I've ever seen a woman in Michael Bay movies. Now there's slight variations within those. Like for example, in Bad Boys, yeah, of course we have Taya Leone, who, you know, she's on the run. She's essentially a damsel in distress. She's allowed to have a snarky line now and then, but she's there to look hot,
mm-hmm.
and she's there to get saved from terrible danger by the bad boys. You also have and I might be getting this wrong, essentially like the chief of police, who happens to be like the sex bomb lady, but she's like a ball breaker.
Yeah. You know? So she's the internal affairs.
Internal affairs. Yes. That's what it is. But she's there to just, you know, essentially, my wife and I have a going joke. Whenever anything goes wrong, I always slam my fist on a table and I say, "Damn it, your methods are unorthodox." Because that's what every chief of police internal affairs officer has ever yelled, essentially, at any cop on the edge and any action flick. That's right. All it is. And so essentially, you know, this sex bomb lady comes in to slam her fist on the table and scream at the bad boys, "Your methods are unorthodox," so that she can leave and they can just be cool as hell as they walk out the door and continue to break the rules.
Absolutely.
And, that's it.
And start making fun of how like the chief and she need to get it on, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, you're on your way to being reassigned. Shut down.
You're gonna reassign me, you? You don't have the authority to reassign me. So until you do, stay the hell out of here.
They should just bone and get that shit over with.
That's really the problem, is the sexual tension between these.
That's exactly it. Yeah. But women are there to either inspire sex or to kind of be something that you can laugh about how unattractive they are.
So there's a history of women having problems with Michael Bay. I guess Megan Fox,
sure.
Kate Beckinsale in Pearl Harbor.
Mm.
I think he told her that she needed to lose weight.
Michael Bay did.
Yeah, for the role.
Mm-hmm.
And
Kate Beckinsale, lose some weight.
Right. There's only one reason why I think he would say that, which is you are a prop.
Like, yeah.
You are supposed to look a certain way. You're not supposed to, it's not an acting.
Is there any way you could look a little more porny? This is a Michael Bay.
Yeah, movie. And in a tragedy like Pearl Harbor, I think that kind of speaks to what you're saying.
Yeah, on the one hand, yeah, that's gross. On the other hand, have you ever seen a Michael Bay movie that bucks that trend? Of course not. And I'm not saying, oh, that's her fault for getting involved in it. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying, I mean...
Of course.
Well, right. Yeah, of course. I mean, of course that's what he thinks. And that's not a justification, but it's just that I found myself watching it with 2018 eyes, Bad Boys in particular, but even some of the other movies in his catalog that I would sort of scrub through a little bit in preparation for this. And I thought, oh my God, it's this sort of low hum sexism in a way where he's seeing women as something less than what women are. But he was at a level that I was actually kind of actively annoyed with Bad Boys for, and his other movies, frankly, for operating on that, what I found to be a kind of distasteful level, just in that aspect.
No, I think that's a good point. I think that one of the things that Michael Bay does, and maybe this is because of his approach, he doesn't counter maybe some of the unhelpful prejudices that we have towards certain things.
Yeah.
So thinking about Bad Boys specifically, you have the cliche, the married guy who is kind of shackled, sexless, in opposition to the unmarried guy who's having sex with different women whenever he'd like to, and oh boy, is it exhausting, right,
yeah,
to keep up with all these women. That just seems like a really like overplayed, tired cliche that reinforces an idea of relationships, but also appeals, I don't know if at 13, but maybe appeals to a certain age at that, where it's like, oh yeah, of course, this is what I think, and this is just keeping me in that narrow way of thinking about relationships, commitment, all those sorts of things.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing that's sort of interesting, and I think what would go along with that cliche, is for everyone to learn a special lesson at the end about how Martin Lawrence actually was the guy with the real treasure, since he has kids and he has a wife and he's got all this beautiful family stability. And it's actually Will Smith with his Porsche and his women that want to get it on with him constantly, that he's really the poor man of the two. And, you know, that's the classical setup and that's the classical payoff. But what's sort of interesting about Michael Bay is he doesn't really bother with that payoff. He just kind of says, yeah, you know what? We've kind of established up front that Will Smith is better looking and he drives faster cars and he's got looser women in his life. And yeah, I think we're just going to stick with this whole motif of, yeah, he's cooler. He's got a better life. Let's just stay there.
And I think that's so true.
That's it.
Like, I think the last shot is Will Smith walking with Taya Leone,
right,
holding hands. It's not even that they've had like a romantic interest.
No.
But you kind of know where it's going.
The life that he's led is paying off.
Good for him. Good for Mike Lowry, right?
But you know what? That's something else that I was thinking about. So, of course, which is, I think, in some ways another Bay staple, which is ridiculous contrivances to serve up a badass or funny badass line or moment or cool visual or something like that. So, perfect example, and this is right off the bat in the film. So Will Smith, a narcotics officer, of course drives a Porsche.
Of course. Why wouldn't he?
It's just what he has. And so, and they establish really early because they know they're going to get shit for this. So they write it into the script. Okay, how can we justify the fact that these two drive around in this incredible car?
Yeah.
Well, let's say that Will Smith's a trust fund baby.
Yep.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it. And that's why he lives in this amazing apartment with all this cool architecture and all this kind of stuff. It's so insane that this guy would drive the car that he drives, not just drive the car that he drives, but drive it on busts and things like that.
All the time.
While he's on the job. And whatnot.
And it's just so because fast.
Of a going joke. There's no legitimacy to the whole thing. But the fact of the matter is, if you're watching a Michael Bay movie, if you're already in the Michael Bay vibe, you don't give a damn.
No.
It's a fast car. It's, you know, that's the way it goes, man.
I mean, one of my favorite things, most of the humor between Marcus and Mike is based on this misunderstanding that Martin Lawrence is Will Smith's character.
Okay, let's describe for the audience, first of all, in case they haven't seen it.
No.
So what happens?
In case you haven't seen
Bad Boys, Taya Leone has heard that Will Smith's character is trustworthy. She's never actually met him. She's in a situation where she's running from these drug kingpin people.
Yes.
And she's in mortal danger. And so she's hiding out, hoping to meet Will Smith.
Because her friend who dies says before she dies, of course, so cleverly, that if I was ever in trouble, Mike is the only person I would call.
So she does, but she accidentally gets Martin Lawrence on the phone. And he has to, in order to win her trust, pretend to be Will Smith's character, which adds up to a whole series of contrivances in which then Will Smith has to pretend to be Martin Lawrence's character to keep up this sort of
For the
lie.
Majority of the film.
And it's the easiest problem to solve at any given moment.
Anytime.
But they never do.
No.
They never say, oh, by the way, Taya Leone, sorry we had to do that a few minutes ago. By the way, I'm actually Mike Lowry and this is actually Marcus, whatever. So anyway, now you know that. Okay, now let's move on with the movie. But they don't. They keep this stupid contrivance going for, what, 70% of the movie?
You don't talk to her now, she's gonna walk.
Captain, I can't be no Mike, man.
Just talk to her now, she's gonna walk out. This is our witness.
Calm down. Hello? It's Mike Lowry.
And I think it hit me, like it was already ridiculous, and then the moment it was so ridiculous was when that Taya Leone is in the apartment with Martin Lawrence's character and she starts to talk about Will Smith's character. Well, I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like to be married to him. Blah, 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 blah. Martin Lawrence like, oh my gosh, my wife is probably attracted to him.
Sure.
He calls and they're talking about a photo and then she's like, put it back in.
This one goes on the bulletin board at work.
Uh-uh. Don't do that. No, come on, Mike, put it back in. I cannot believe you took it out. Come on. Marcus will kill us if he finds out. Give it to him.
I can't believe I let you see it.
Motherfucker!
And it ends up with people chasing each other around in their underwear. And
yes, and he says, where's the girl, right? Where's Taya Leone? She's like, oh, she's in the car. And he says, do you want to blow the case?
Blow the case?
Blow the case? How is the whole case based on this one crazy mix-up?
Right. So in the larger sense, every Michael Bay movie has plot holes big enough to drive an Armageddon-sized asteroid through. Put
and
it that way.
And that's the thing, right? I mean, what is it? They're going to drill into
the... Well,
that
was even a quote from Ben Affleck. He was just like, you know, I'll never forget the day I went up to Michael Bay on the set. And I said, quick question. Is it easier to train a bunch of drillers to be astronauts, or a bunch of astronauts to drill a hole. Right. And yes. Michael Bay essentially said, maybe just shut the fuck up.
Yeah, right. Which is true. And so this brings me to an interesting thought about one of the Michael Bay films I love. Well,
own it.
I don't know if I love it.
Own
though,
it.
Which is Pain and Gain.
Love it.
And that true story mm-hmm. is so ridiculous that only Michael Bay yeah. could do justice to it.
Can I want to say this, because I also love Pain and Gain. I think it's a great film. I think it's more than a good film. I think it's a great film. In fact, I saw Pain and Gain. And by the way, if you're listening and if you haven't seen Pain and Gain, as soon as you're done hearing this episode, go out, watch it. Fantastic movie. When
it
I
really
finished
is.
That movie, I said, this is the movie that Michael Bay should be making. Not Transformers and not on and on and blah, 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 blah. All his many, many full library stuff. Pain and Gain, essentially a movie about roid rage.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the movie that fits the Michael Bay aesthetic, because finally there's a reason to do this Bayhem thing that Michael Bay does. And it works perfectly in that context.
It's so good. And you have the craziest things happen and they don't seem real. But they happened.
Right.
And somehow, in the way that Michael Bay can do, is he does justice to that.
Yeah, really, really solid film. So I was hoping to talk a little bit also about the craft of Michael Bay.
He does have one. Right? He has a style, at least.
Without a doubt. Now, we've talked about the explosions. We've talked about the humor. We've talked about the women as objects and all that. Clearly, he's an action guy. He gravitates toward this very specific genre, the big budget action film. That's what Michael Bay was made for. But what is it about Michael Bay, craft-wise, that makes him Michael Bay? Daniel, you and I have talked about this. Mm-hmm. We're both fans of, you know, the YouTube series, Every Frame a Painting.
Right.
Great series. They do an episode on Michael Bay. And by the way, quite frankly, I don't personally have anything more profound to say than what's said
it's so
in the Michael
good.
Bay episode of this YouTube series. So go watch it. We'll link to it. He talks specifically about the craft of Michael Bay, mm-hmm. and it really, really clarifies what it is that Michael Bay is doing. And once you see it, you can't unsee it.
You can't. I know.
But
it's
the
true.
Fact of the matter is, Michael Bay doesn't know how to do a scene without a camera that's moving all over the place.
All the time, everywhere.
Constantly, constantly moving camera. Moving, I'm even going to go as far as to say, in most cases, without any purpose mm-hmm. at all. It's just moving to move. It's moving to give importance to things, whether they're actually important or not. It's moving to give the audience this sense of tension and urgency, and I'm even going to go so far as to say stress.
Yeah.
He wants to stress out his audience. He wants to amp them up. He wants to put a bunch of methamphetamines mm-hmm. down our necks.
Yes.
So that every scene, even something as simple as a throwaway line or a conversation or even a shot of someone who's just sitting there and eating lunch, turns into this sort of epic, this ride of the Valkyries that you're mm-hmm. that you're right on the edge, you're looking over the edge of the cliff into this imminent disaster or something like that. And when you really stop and you pull back, you're like, oh, hang on, this is just a person who's ordering a Big Mac at McDonald's. So
yeah.
why do I feel like this is the most tense epic thing that's ever happened? That's Michael Bay behind the camera saying, keep that thing moving, use all the devices that you possibly can to make this thing as tense as possible.
But I really noticed this in the scene Bad Boys. And again, there's so many different elements. You have the moving camera, you have the humor, the music, which I'm not sure if Every Frame of Painting highlights the music, but I think it's so key to what Michael Bay is doing, to the point where it's really confusing. Like, music comes in, stops, comes in again, as if to accentuate something, and you're like, wait a second, I don't know. Did something just get sinister or yeah. suspenseful?
But always big.
Always big. But there's that moment when Marcus, Martin Lawrence's character, is looking through the headshots on the computer with Taya Leone, and he's eating the bologna sandwich, and she starts to make fun of him for it.
That's flesh that you're shoveling into your mouth. You know, that was like a living, breathing creature, you know? It probably had a name.
It's just bologna. My bologna has a first name.
Well, actually, your bologna has about 30 names, you know, because they take, like, odd parts from all different ones, you know, like the leftovers, like the hooves, you know, stomach lining, ears, stuff like that, you know, and they put it into this machine and like grind it all up, and then out comes like this sheet. Okay.
The camera's moving, you have this music, and the humor comes in, I think it kind of goes down, and then she notices the guy's picture, and then it kind of goes up again. The same thing happens the whole time. Like, there is no dynamic quality to the scene, at least in tone and in acting. Right. It feels so, like, forced.
Yeah, it's a manufactured tension rather than a story tension.
It wasn't until preparation for this that I started to kind of watch with different eyes, right? It's right away in the first few shots with the Porsche that he does this thing with editing. You have the Porsche going across this bridge. It's almost like this cut to a close-up of the Porsche's door.
Right.
And then back again to like a medium shot of the Porsche going fast.
Right.
And it happens within a second. It just, it feels really frenetic. And you're like, what? There is nothing happening. Like, you haven't even met the characters really. They're not driving anywhere of importance. And here's this frenetic scene as if to suggest, like, nothing is simple. Mm-hmm. Everything is big and serious and needs to kind of be received in that way.
Yeah. Michael Bay's whole background is in doing high-end music videos. I mean, you look back through his catalog, especially at the time, at the different music videos that he works on, bands like Styx, Slaughter, Winger, there's Tina Turner, there's Vanilla Ice, there's, you know, Meatloaf. And you'll look at the different videos that he's directed, the different songs from these artists. In some cases, it'll be some of their biggest songs. Mm. These ultra, you know, certainly what was at the time, cutting edge. Well, maybe cutting edge is the wrong word. Definitely big budget, though.
Yeah.
Definitely high-end premium product videos. But they were all using these sort of devices with the editing and the colored gels, the lights that were hitting everything. The distressed film, Flappy Flap, you know, of that kind of stuff that would be a part of these transitions and things like that. Anything that can be used to inject more energy, more meth into every frame that they can possibly get that into. And I think Michael Bay, coming from that background, knowing that he's got, you know, whatever a song is, you know, he's got 3 minutes to inject as much energy and as much, you know, even if it's an artificial energy as he can. And that's what he knows. So I think he goes into Bad Boys saying, I guess this is a 2-hour music video, really. And that's how he treats it. The camera is never not moving. And the editing is never not super frenetic and super just roided out, I guess. There are cases, like I'm even thinking of like 13 Hours, for example, which is still wholly a Michael Bay movie.
Oh, yeah.
In my opinion, maybe slightly more measured than, and I mean slightly, than his typical output with all this insanity of all the Transformers movies and all that, The Rock or Armageddon or, you know, whatever it is. So I can't say that he hasn't matured at all. I don't know. I see a guy sort of falling back on what he knows, pumping adrenaline into every moment possible. I mean, that's what people like, right?
That's what people like. And he doesn't care, right? I mean, I think that he's fine with it.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's a self-awareness there where he's like, I know I'm doing this? Or do you think he's just like...
I think he knows the kind of movie he's making. I think he knows that he's trying to ram as much in front of his audience's eyeballs as possible. I don't know, maybe this is an auxiliary question. Does he want to make a calmer movie?
I think he knows the types of movies he wants to make. I mean, he's making them. He could experiment and explore and take risks creatively if he wanted to.
Yeah.
And he just chooses not to, right? I mean, I think, because people are going to still go see the movies. The guy, his gross in terms of what he's made over time is insane.
Yeah.
It's in the billions at this point.
As in like the box office of his films?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's intense. I mean, Michael Bay is going to make a movie. He's not going to make a movie that doesn't pack him out and pack him in, you know? He knows that's what he's there for. And to be fair, and I say this as someone who's been on sets and things, it is impressive what he does. The energy and the effort that goes into every single one of these shots, while it kind of gives me a headache, it's also like, wow, I mean, just knowing what goes into setting up a shot, that insane shot that he sets up, and the timing that has to go into that, all the lighting, just all the manufacturing that has to go into setting up the insanity of these shots. In all honesty, it is extremely impressive. I don't think that the concert of all of these things adds up to a product that I'm interested in personally, but it is amazing. I will say that. So Michael Bay does a thing. I call it the Michael Bay swirl.
Oh, yeah. It's got, it is.
You know
yeah.
the thing I'm talking yeah. about.
MBS.
There's a shot that he does, and I just don't think that he's made a movie that doesn't have this shot. It's just, it's his signature shot. So he's got a few things going on at once. And again, this gets a little technical, so I'm going to try my best.
Yeah.
Michael Bay is interested in a couple of things. So from a technical standpoint, I'm not even going to call it a device. Mm-hmm. It's just a reality of photography called parallax. Mm-hmm. The easiest way to describe what parallax is say you're in a car and you're driving and you look out the passenger window and you see off in the distance a building. If the building is far enough away, even if you're driving at a terrific speed, the building is going to pass your window kind of slowly because it's far away, in the same way that a mountain that's even farther and even bigger is going to stay in your view for, you know, maybe upwards of an hour if you're driving in your car. Conversely, between you and that building, you pass a picket fence. Mm-hmm. The slats of that fence are whizzing by. So it's going by quickly because it's in the foreground. Things that are in the extreme background are moving by slowly. Well, that difference, fast to slow, foreground to background, that's parallax. Michael Bay bases his whole aesthetic on this idea.
Yep.
Because he knows and he's discovered that if he keeps his camera moving, you're going to constantly see foreground objects whizzing by and background objects moving, just moving much slower. But that comparison, foreground to background movement, that adds tension and that adds dynamism. He sometimes does it with dollies. He sometimes does it with jibs, with cranes, anything he can do to keep that camera moving, to have foreground objects whizzing by and background objects also going by, just not as fast. It gives you this sort of feeling of epicness, of tension and all that. So the Michael Bay swirl is the culmination of all these different elements. So picture Martin Lawrence and Will Smith. And what he does is he sets up a dolly track in a perfect circle. But the thing is, where most directors, they might set up a dolly track in this circle that has a radius of, you know, 7 or 8 feet. Michael Bay says, forget it. I'm going to have this enormous dolly track that's going to have a radius of, you know, who knows, 50 feet. It's this enormous track. And he's going to point the camera in the center, which is where his subjects are. And he's going to run full tilt with this dolly so that this dolly is going, you know, who knows, 20, 30 miles an hour around this dolly track. But it's always focused on this central character who's in the center. So what it feels like is a camera that's slowly moving around the central character when in fact the camera is actually moving super fast. But the reason that you know it's fast is because he's zoomed way in and the background is whizzing by. So you know, holy cow, if the background is whizzing by that fast, that means we must be really, really cooking. And the only way that he can do that is to make this enormous dolly track swirling around the subjects. Added on to that, he likes to do things like having the characters say some badass line, having them stand up into frame so there's vertical movement. Again, a really, really difficult thing to describe on an audio podcast, but you know it when you see it. It's Michael Bay's signature move. Again, I call it the Bay swirl, and it's this thing that he sort of discovered. What's so interesting is so many people try to replicate the Bay swirl, but they don't quite get there. And the reason they don't get there is because they don't make their dolly track the radius long enough. And so they end up getting sort of like a mini version of it. But Michael Bay says, screw that. I'm going to blow your socks off with this badass moment with this swirly, swirly thing. It's a thing that I swear, much like the constantly moving camera, once you see it, you can't unsee it.
That's really helpful because, so people might not register it in their brain right now, but I guarantee if you watch a trailer for any Michael Bay movie, that shot is in it.
It has to be.
Now, I don't know what it does aside from make something that shouldn't be important feel really important. Mm-hmm. What you said, people standing up, right, is one of those moments when it happens.
Right.
and looking. Like, usually, if you want those moments to be fraught with meaning, mm-hmm. you need to know what the characters are looking at, right? And Michael Bay says, screw that. You don't need to know what the characters are looking at. You just need to know that when they're looking, they look awesome.
Yeah.
That will tell you what you need. Now, it doesn't matter what's off screen. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is also a signature of his style. There's so much happening, and you're not seeing it, and you're supposed to feel it, but it's only because of what the camera is doing in this other space.
Injecting artificial meaning into the meaningless.
Right.
And it's not just camera work that he does this. I mean, you know, Michael Bay movies, which was kind of part of the joke of my intro, they're loaded with these ridiculous one-liners.
Yeah.
Characters not saying anything.
Yeah, right.
Shit just got real doesn't mean anything.
No, it doesn't.
But it's a Michael Bay line. It's something to have them say. Artificial meaning pumped into the meaningless. I think that's at the core of all the big explosions and all the big camera moves and all the craziness, all the Bayhem.
Hashtag Bayhem.
That you see in all these different Michael Bay movies.
So here you have somebody who's concerned with injecting artificial meaning into what is meaningless, right. Which sounds, maybe it's harsh, but then I have the question of what is the role of a Michael Bay film? In filmmaking, in a person's life, watching movies, mm-hmm. is there any value that Michael Bay brings to the art?
You know, I like the fact that this question is becoming the Daniel Long signature question.
Is it?
It is, but it's beautiful.
Okay.
I like it. I'm putting myself in the shoes of people who might be listening right now, and they're like, come on. I mean, you're wanting to do the summer blockbuster. These are popcorn movies. These right. are popcorn directors that you're going to be talking about all summer long. Are you trying to bum me out now? Because I thought this was supposed to be fun. I think it really does go back to what are you looking for in a movie, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Is it okay to just go to a movie and have Michael Bay flick your action G spot for a couple of hours? Flick it. Is that all right? Is that in and of itself a worthy film going experience? Are you a bad moviegoer, if that's all you want? I can't bring myself to go that far with it. You know, that's not why I personally go to movies. Mm-hmm. You know, there's action films that I love. There's action directors that I love. And hopefully maybe we'll get to at least one of those this summer. Mm-hmm. Michael Bay is not one of them. And Michael Bay films, while I'm not against seeing a Michael Bay film, I wouldn't go that far. I can't go so far as to stand in judgment of people who are just like, I don't know. I want to see something blowing up. I want to see some expensive shit. I want to see a car turning into a robot that's going to beat up another robot. That sounds kind of fun to spend my time with for a couple of hours. You know what, man? I get it. I can't say that that's the highest form of stimulation, but sometimes you're in that mood to just be shallow for a little while. And so I can't completely blame a person. I don't even know if that's answering your question. But
no, I think it is answering my question. And I think it does raise, like, why do you engage film? Why do you watch a film? Is film art to a person? For some, it's not an art form. It is something to consume, and it's a piece of entertainment. And I'm not going to make a judgment on how that should be perceived. Mm-hmm. One thing that came up in that conversation between Michael Bay and James Cameron when they were talking about 3D specifically, mm-hmm. you know, Michael Bay was saying how James Cameron, that one of the ways that he got him interested in using 3D technology was describing it as like a toy.
He invited me to the set of Avatar, and he's like one of my idols here. And he says, Michael, we've done everything. And I'm like, well, you sunk the Titanic. I didn't, so I got a lot more to do. But he said, it's you got to look at it as a toy. It's another fun tool to help get emotion and character and create an experience. And I'm always trying to create a great summer experience for the moviegoer.
When I heard that, I'm like, yeah, that makes actually a lot of sense. His films, they are like a toy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, which it seems degrading in a way already to just kind of name it in that way.
Sure.
But he doesn't see it that way. Like, he doesn't see film as and thinking of it in that way, thinking of it as entertainment, thinking about it in terms of, yeah, maybe my movies aren't great, but people come and watch them, and I'm fine with that, right?
Right.
And I do think there's something wonderful about that, right? Like, people watch movies for different reasons, people receiving it in a different way. And I just think Michael Bay, I really don't think he thinks he's making art.
You don't think he would say he's making art?
I don't think, maybe that's like a harsh statement. I actually don't think he thinks that, at least from that comment in that interview. Yeah.
That's hard for me to imagine that Michael Bay doesn't think that he's making art, but maybe you're right.
No, maybe that's a dickish thing to say.
No. I mean, I can see it either way, honestly. You know what? It sort of leads me into another question, which is, do filmmakers like Noah Baumbach or Alexander Payne, do they have anything they can learn from Michael Bay?
Wow. It's a great question.
I mean, I think the inverse is a pretty clear answer.
Well, yeah, and I think that's really, I think, revealing of my own kind of sensibility, which is why I appreciate the question. I feel like it kind of exposes my own internal, maybe, arrogance. Oh, man, I don't know how to answer that. I do wonder if there's a, and I use this word lightly, but I wonder if there's a fun element to the way that Michael Bay approaches film that allows for a type of freedom that maybe a Noah Baumbach or an Alexander Payne, they don't feel when they're making a movie. So that's not to say that they need to make movies like Michael Bay makes them. I would like to see how they are on set. Mm-hmm. If maybe Michael Bay, his approach would allow them space to maybe enjoy it.
Right.
What's the filmmaking experience for both of them like?
Many of us have heard the stories about how difficult and angry Michael Bay is on the set and how the kind of tantrums that he throws and all that. I see a Michael Bay film and I think, well, of course. And I don't say, of course, like, well, of course, someone who would make such immature movies is going to be an immature narcissist on the set. I mean, maybe that's part of it. But to me, it makes sense in a different way. When I see the complexity of these setups and what he's asking his actors to do and his DP to do and his effects supervisors to do and on down the line, down to every gaffer and every grip and all that that he hires to make all this possible, it's difficult to describe how hard it is to get these kinds of shots. Mm. It's near on impossible. They require 19 things to happen all at the same time, and all of them need to happen flawlessly.
And with a different person in charge.
Yeah.
Or responsible.
It's such a miracle of coordination. It's honestly hard to describe. And it's, well, super expensive. We're losing daylight. That is a thing. There's a limited amount of time to get these shots, and they have to go so like clockwork that if the smallest thing is wrong, the shot's literally unusable.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't think it is just that Michael Bay is like this immature narcissist. I think at the end of the day, he's painted himself into this corner where the shots he has to get are so complex that I think he's probably at his wit's end a lot of times when he's on these sets. And, you know, you've got a Megan Fox rolling her eyes and going like, I don't know. I don't really feel that or something like that. And if that's going on, yeah, I'd probably want to choke somebody if I were Michael Bay. Now, clearly, Michael Bay's got his own problems that are, you know, these these problems with women, and that's his thing. You know, you have sometimes these prima donna personalities, and they're rubbing up against each other. All that's to say, I get it. I can completely understand it. Somehow, though, with all the stress and all that, Michael Bay continues to do what he does. That alone, I feel like maybe that's one thing that our indie darlings might be able to learn from Michael Bay, which is to make a movie at all, you've got to be resilient as hell. To make a Michael Bay movie, you have to be superhuman. Maybe there's something there. Yeah. I don't know. I'm just throwing something out.
No, I think that's a generous way of thinking about it.
Yeah. So I don't know. Weird question, but there's stuff that Michael Bay was doing in Bad Boys that you think that he thought better of later. I mean, sure, there's bad stuff in Bad Boys, but
here's what I think Michael Bay ended up doing later, is he said, you know what? There aren't enough stars in my picture.
Will Smith wasn't big enough.
Will Smith wasn't big enough. Martin Lawrence wasn't big enough. So next up, I'm going to do Nicolas Cage, Sean Connery, Ed Harris. I just feel like the ensemble casts just get bigger and bigger and bigger. Like the people he gets to work for him, it's insane. John Turturro is in Transformers, I think, alongside. Is Anthony Hopkins in a Transformers movie?
That sounds right.
I mean, this is crazy that he gets these people to work for him. And I do think that's one of the things that in Bad Boys that he didn't do. I mean, he had Star, but he just keeps getting more stars.
Yeah. I mean, and actually that was going to be really my only, and it wasn't specific to stars, but I thought he makes Bad Boys for $15 million. I think Michael Bay walks away thinking, well, I'm never going to do a movie for that cheap again.
Right. It's true.
Otherwise, aesthetically and all that,
it's all there.
I think he kind of felt like he nailed it.
Yeah, I think he did. I'm just going to keep doing this thing.
And he did. Bad Boys 2. You know, there it is.
Oh, man. Bad Boy. Have you seen Bad Boys 2?
I don't think I've seen all of it, but for this, I think I watched the first half. And in true sequel fashion, he said, let's take the first one and amp it up.
Right. Did you at least see the driving of the Hummer through the, I don't know, this village? Every time it goes through a new house, there's just a new explosion.
Each time the Hummer goes through a new house.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's exactly what I said. The Hummer goes through. Oh, man.
Yeah, so it's not so much a maturity as, well, he's matured. I think it may not be as profoundly as maybe some of us would have liked, but I think there's been a maturity there. Like I said, I look at Bad Boys next to, for example, 13 Hours.
Right.
I do think his craft has improved. I don't know that I would go so far as to call it subtlety, but I think there's finer storytelling methods that he's honed a little since those days. Yeah, and Pain and Gain, I think he
so good.
He found his vibe.
Yeah, I think that's true.
But yeah, I don't know. I don't know that he's that much different than the Michael Bay that made Bad Boys.
Yeah, and he's totally cool with it.
Yeah. All right, so we're talking about the guy who made 13 Hours, Pain and Gain, five different, how many Transformers movies are there?
I lost count after three.
I think there's five Transformers movies. Pearl Harbor, Armageddon, two Bad Boys movies, The Rock. I mean, it's just, if you can't see a pattern here, then, you know, I don't know what to tell you. Of all these movies, which puzzle piece is Bad Boys in the Michael Bay tapestry?
See, I feel like it's a little bit complicated because I would just remove all of the Transformers movies. I was to put all of those at the bottom, then all of a sudden Bad Boys rises to the upper half of his...
It's the pedestal that his other films stand upon.
No, I think that's true. I would actually say in terms of his catalog, Bad Boys is one of the better movies.
You'd say, okay.
I would rather watch Bad Boys over Pearl Harbor. I would rather watch Bad Boys over Bad Boys 2.
Any of the Transformers.
I mean, it makes it complicated in answering the question, but if I was going to answer it honestly, that's how I at least do the math on it.
Well, crap, dude. When you put it like that, I guess you're right. I mean, I can't argue with that. I guess that's true. I mean, you know, I look at Bad Boys and, I mean, it's an eye roll. It really is.
Well, yeah, the whole thing is an eye roll.
It's not as intense as an eye roll as maybe at least half of his catalog, though. All right. You know what? I'm going to agree with your assessment.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know what else to say. I don't want to just keep harping on what an odd outlier Pain and Gain is, because it's such a great film.
But it's so far up there, right at the top.
And it's his most, you know what I think it is? Because like I said, I don't think that 13 Hours was a bad film.
Right. I think that's right.
I actually didn't mind the Michael Bay take on the chaos of Benghazi, you know? It was a little much. It's not my film of choice, but there was a part of it when that was some crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's good for me to see that was some crazy stuff.
I wonder if it helps with that film in particular that aside from John Krasinski, there aren't many... there aren't stars.
No, and I don't... I think part of what I appreciated also about 13 Hours was the fact that he's not even really trying to posture. You know, he's not trying to show a shallow relationship and pretend that it's deep. It's just not really what the movie's about.
That's
and,
good, yeah.
And I appreciate that about that movie. Same about Pain and Gain. He's not pretending anymore. He's just like, okay, I'm not going to do my usual thing. I found a script that highlights what I'm good at, and I'm just going to do that.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. And how do you make more films like that?
But I'll tell you the truth. I hope he does.
Mm-hmm.
Bad Boys, 1995 film, Will Smith, Martin Lawrence, directed by blockbuster director Michael Bay. Film people should watch, completists only. Is that even an appropriate question in this context?
I mean, I feel like you complicated the question in a way that makes me like, oh. You know, so you said, is this something film people should watch? Mm-hmm. Are people who listen to this podcast exclusively film people? I don't know. You know what? And I'm going to stand by it, and I think this is okay to say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's for completists only.
Mm-hmm.
I think, no.
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 No qualifiers.
No.
All right.
I think you could watch this movie and eye roll
mm-hmm.
all throughout it.
Yeah. I think it's a weird question in this context, because if you're the kind of person who would like it, you've probably seen it. You know?
Right. That's a good point.
I don't think that we're alerting anyone to the existence of Bad Boys that has any interest in seeing it.
I don't know, man. You just watched this for the first time recently.
That's true. That's true. I also just watched Piranha 2 for the first time a couple months ago.
Yeah, it's also good.
Who knows? If you are a Michael Bay person, you know what, dude? You're gonna love it. Dig in.
Yeah.
Will Smith, Martin Lawrence, hilarious. Quality jollity.
So good.
All the way through. You're gonna have a super time. For me, not my kind of thing. If you're a listener of the Freshman 15, I would say you probably interact with films in a way that you may not be a Michael Bay person. That sounds snobby, doesn't it? I don't mean it to.
No.
It's probably the truth, though, right?
No, it's totally true. I do think that, so this is, I don't know if we've ever gotten.
If you're a Michael Bay person, this podcast probably irritates the shit out of you.
That's a good point. This isn't a film to return to.
Yeah. Which is funny that the sequel exists.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a one and done-er.
Yeah, I think so.
I think we're more or less on the same page. Bad Boys, Michael Bay's freshman film, 1995. If you're a Michael Bay person, well, as Daniel says, you may or may not want to return to it, but I don't know, you probably already know what the whole thing's about. Go back, enjoy it again if you really, really are feeling that nostalgia itch. Otherwise, it's Michael Bay. Who gives a damn? That's my feeling on the whole thing.
You know what? It's as if Michael Bay just directed you. It's Michael Bay. Who gives a damn?
That's the poster. I want to see that at the bottom of Transformers Part 19.
Right.
That's the log line.
He'd say, I'm Michael Bay. I don't care. Right? That could be one of the lines too. So thanks for listening. We love to hear your feedback. Again, thanks to Nate Dunleavy for making the trek over here to give us some feedback on air.
What a great guy.
Absolutely. But you can email us. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram. Email us at freshman15film@gmail.com. That's freshman15film@gmail.com. Also, we'd love for you to rate us on iTunes. It helps people find our podcast so that they can listen to it and enjoy it as well.
So, of course, this is still Jeremy and Daniel, so we're not going to let you go without pumping up our favorite streaming movie service, and of course, that's Filmstruck. If you have any interest at all in the Criterion Collection of Film, Turner Classic Movies, some of the greatest films, greatest directors ever, get a subscription. You're not going to go wrong. Filmstruck.
And it's crazy because this month they're highlighting Bad Boys on Filmstruck, which isn't true. You can't find it on Filmstruck because they show good films there.
All right, everybody. Well, I guess we'll see you again next month where you can find out what part two of our summer blockbuster movies is all about.
Kaboom!
Can't wait, can't wait. Until then, I'm Jeremy Bear.
And I'm Daniel Long.
Talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening.